right now. Steve McCabe is our technology commentator in the Auckland studio. Nice to talk to you, Steve. How are things?
Not so bad, thank you, Catherine. How are you?
That's good. Facebook, I'm good, thanks. Facebook is buying Instagram.
Yes.
Now, Facebook, I know, you'd have to be, you know, sort of in a very deep, dark place in the forest, perhaps not to have heard of Facebook.
Because you're on Facebook, aren't you, Catherine?
No. No, you knew that. I don't.
Sorry.
Facebook.
Sorry.
What is Instagram?
Well, Instagram is another of these, if you don't share it, then it didn't really happen kind of networks. But Instagram has got two little gimmicks with it, basically. One is it's photos only. It's a photo-sharing site. The idea is that if you've got your iPhone, and until last week it was an iPhone-only experience, you take pictures with your iPhone, and then you get the other big gimmick. It's got filters. So suddenly you can make your photograph look like it was taken in the 1970s. It's got all sepia-toned, and the colours are all washed out. And then you upload them to the file-sharing site, and people around the world can see your photographs. And that's it.
Right.
And that apparently was worth $1 billion.
So it's what? It's a file sharing site.
We have to be very careful with our language in New Zealand these days, because file sharing will get the US government down on you. We're not Kim.com here. Now, this is photo sharing. The idea is that I take a photograph of a thing and I think, wow, that photograph would look so much better with washed out colours and a square aspect ratio. So I run it through Instagram and then I post it on the Instagram site. And you and the rest of the world can take a look at it.
Okay, so it gives it that oldie-worldy kind of...
That's the one, yes.
What's the other word? Sepia? Is that a sepia look?
I believe they have a sepia filter, yeah. There's the sort of the washed out, this photograph was taken in the 70s and the colours are fading kind of look. There's about 20 different filters, and that's their big gimmick, is these processing things you can do to your pictures.
So what is this company worth?
Well, if you're Facebook, it's worth $1 billion.
They paid $1 billion for it?
Yes. Now, that's what Facebook is saying it's worth. I'm a tech commentator. I'm not a business commentator. So I don't see why it would be that a company that has never once generated a single penny of revenue will be worth that much.
Well, it might be if you start making it generate revenue. How has it worked to date?
Well, it doesn't. Basically, the only revenue it's actually managed to bring in so far has been investments from venture capitalists, which is kind of weird, really. They're currently running on the fumes of a $500,000 investment that got them started. There's about a dozen fellas over in the US running this company. They give away their app for free, so the software is free. You're not paying to use it. Their website is free. It's free to upload your photographs. There's no advertising on the site. There is no revenue-generating process in their business model.
So why does Facebook want it? What's in it?
Well, that's a very good question. It's one that a lot of people have been kicking around here. There's a number of different theories. I mean, the obvious one is that the $1 billion were burning a huge hole in Mark Zuckerberg's pocket, which is quite possible. I mean, I can sympathise with that. If I had $1 billion kicking around, I would not to do it either. That's one thing. The other thing is that at the moment, Instagram are kind of small, but they're getting big. They are possibly Facebook's only real social network rival. They've managed to steamroll everybody else. I mean, MySpace is pretty much dead and gone these days. Bebo is a thing of the past. There's nobody left. Instagram was the only thing that was actually looking like it was doing something social networky that Facebook couldn't just own.
So this is a case of eating up your competitors?
Quite possibly, because it's the only realistic one. I mean, Twitter is possible, but they're so huge now that no one's going to buy them. So yeah, basically, that's one way of looking at it.
It's been in the news, Instagram, for other reasons, hasn't it?
Well, it is. It's kind of weird, actually. Bit of ice snobbery going on here. As I said before, it's been an iPhone-only app until quite recently. In the last week, suddenly they lowered the tone considerably by opening up to the Android platform, which is Android's Google's alternative to the iPhone infrastructure. So they've opened it up to that, and then suddenly now iPhone users are basically saying, oh, no, there goes the neighbourhood. bit pathetic, really.
I see.
Yeah, so been tweets along the lines of, oh, great, now we can see how poor people live, which is absolutely shocking.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Android is making gains, though, is it not, in the size of its share?
Oh, little by little, yeah. I mean, it's a tricky one because it's hard to talk about the Android platform because there's so many different people can sell phones that run Android, whereas the iPhone is an all-or-nothing thing. You either get an iPhone with the iPhone operating system from Apple or you don't. Android is a million different things.
Snobbery, I'm wondering if you're going to end up facing patent issues over that one. Not allowed to put I in front of things for the most part, are you?
I said it first.
Well, you can't take I. That's a good point, actually. They can't nick I back, surely.
Yes, an entire 26 of the alphabet owned by Apple.
Yes, yes indeed. Now, there's a developer who's had to pull a particular app from an app store. The app is intriguingly called Girls Around Me.
Yeah, this is a bit squalid, this one, to be perfectly honest. This is a Russian developer called iFree, and they released an application that takes information from two conflicting social networks. What happens is they find any young ladies who are posting on the Foursquare system, which is basically a way of checking in and saying, hey, I'm here, look what I'm doing. They're finding women, young women, who are posting their check-ins on Foursquare, particularly in bars and such places. They are then matching that up with Facebook profiles, in particular if they're finding photographs of these women on their Facebook profiles, are then posting this to a map. So basically, young gentlemen who are purely interested in conversation, of course, can then look on their iPhone apps and go, oh, there's a young lady down the road having a drink in a bar and she looks pretty.
So this Foursquare thing actually says where you are at a given time.
Well, yeah, it's something you voluntarily choose to do. You open up a Foursquare and you click, I've checked in at this bar. So you're doing it voluntarily. But it was always assumed that this was being done to a certain extent with your own knowledge, and you understood that it was staying within Foursquare. What iFree, the developers of this app, did was they then took that information and aggregated it with other information from Facebook and then put it all together to basically make a stalker app.
What sort of other information from Facebook? I mean, are they actually uplifting the photos or what?
Oh, photos and pretty much anything else you make public. So the way...
So they're turning it into kind of a dating website without the individual knowing that that's how it's being used.
And unfortunately, that's exactly right. So what's going to happen is, if I were of the stalker persuasion, and I'm not, I could sort of sidle up to some young lady in the bar and sort of steer the conversation around to puppies, because I know that she's just got a new puppy. Or, oh, I love puppies too.
So it's actually putting all this information off your Facebook. But how can they get into Facebook? Is this a case if you don't have the privacy apps working or privacy whatever settings working, or are they able to get in there no matter what?
No, that's the entire problem, is they're being a little bit disingenuous and they're going all innocently and, you know, oh, well, it's all publicly available information. And
is it all publicly available information?
Yeah,
even if you have got your privacy settings so that only your immediate friends and families can see your Facebook page.
No, what they're doing is they're taking advantage of the fact that, unfortunately, an awful lot of people are a little bit innocent and naive still about what they don't actually get round to making private. A lot of people, they're naive enough to think that it doesn't matter, or they simply aren't aware that they can and should.
Is this a violation of privacy, or should people be thinking twice before putting their exact location up on a public social network?
Yes.
Anyway?
Yeah, I mean, it's both. It is an invasion of privacy, but we live in a world now where people are being constantly encouraged to divulge every last little nugget of their lives. You know, you're expected to say, oh, I'm walking down the street now. Oh, and I'm crossing the street now. Oh, I just walked past somewhere now. We're expected constantly to be documenting every second of our lives. There is that social pressure, especially among the younger set, obviously. You know, it's what people do now, that you broadcast constantly what you're doing. And as a result, the people are now finding ways to exploit that, take the information that people are, I'm going to say willingly giving out, but I do believe there's
naively
a certain degree...
Naively giving out.
Yeah, I believe there's a certain degree of social pressure as well. Possibly people are maybe giving out more than they're entirely comfortable with, but there's that little nugget of peer pressure going on as well.
Is there a moral to the story then?
Well, absolutely there is. You have to remember that anything you ever post is public. The moment it hits the internet, it's out of your hands, and people will have the opportunity to do what they want with it, and not everyone is going to be innocent and naive with the information. There are people who will use that information in nefarious ways.
Now, there's a Mac botnet. What next? We know what a botnet is. What's a Mac botnet?
Well, it always used to be that the Apple users, Mac users, were absolutely convinced that their computers were immune to any kind of viruses and malware. And for the longest time, while that wasn't strictly true, in effect, it tended toward truth, because people weren't really writing malicious software that was going to infect Macs for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is technically a little bit harder. And secondly, when these computers represented, say, 1% of the market, why bother? Why go to the trouble when it's much easier to write something that's going to affect PCs and get 99% of the install base? Suddenly, with things like, for example, the iPhone and the iPod, suddenly you're seeing Macintosh computers much more widespread. Suddenly people are going, hang on a second, I can take advantage of that. And it's finally happened that there is now a very large and very significant malware infestation program called Flashback, that's being spread via websites that, that Mac users can go to and find their computer getting infected.
So what had you been saying earlier? It was very hard to break into. How much has the botnet got around the traps now?
Well, I mean, there's always been ways around these things. What they've done basically is that whoever wrote this, and we're not quite sure at this point at the moment who's behind it, but whoever's written this has found a weakness, found a little backdoor in Safari, which is the web browser that comes by default with all Macintosh computers. And they figured out a way of getting websites to run a little bit of programming code in the background, which can then work its way into your computer and start accessing things like your passwords. And the implication then is, for example, if they get hold of your bank online banking passwords, they can then access your bank accounts. You know, the idea then is they can take all your money from you as well.
What does this mean? Most people have some kind of antivirus on their computers these days, don't they?
Well, again, this is the way it's always been. Mac users tend not to, because there's always been this belief for the longest time that well, if you're a Mac user, you don't need one. And Apple have never actually specifically said that. They've been very, very careful not to say that Mac users don't get viruses. But they've been quite happy for people to believe that there's a substantially lower chance. And so Mac users tend not to, which is unwise.
Yeah, and what you're indicating now is the time, if you haven't, to think about it, yeah?
It's the end of innocence for Mac users, definitely. Yeah, we finally realise that the Mac platform is, first of all, it is vulnerable, and secondly, those vulnerabilities are actually starting to get exploited, not just in a proof-of-concept kind of way, which has happened in the past, but there's actually something in the wild that is actually quite potentially harmful.
Now, your last segment today is to do, well, it's an obituary effectively, isn't it? Who is Jack Tramiel, is it?
I believe it's pronounced here, Tramiel. Very, very interesting bloke. I mean, I remember last year when Steve Jobs died, obviously everybody knew immediately who he was, and there was an enormous media thing about him because, you know, it's an enormous figure. But Jack Tramiel was, I mean, you could possibly make the case that without people like him, there would never have been a Steve Jobs. He's a fascinating bloke. He was an Auschwitz survivor who, after the war, moved to the United States, and he did all kinds of things. He joined the US Army. He was a taxi driver. He repaired typewriters. He did all kinds of things.
But then wonderful old technology that was.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, this fellow was old school in the best possible way. He was brilliant. But then in the mid-70s, he founded the Commodore Computer Company.
Oh, well, they were huge for ages, weren't they?
Exactly, yeah, they were fantastic. I mean, when I was back in high school in England in the 1980s...
The only computer we got to see wasn't ours, but it was probably a Commodore.
It was a Commodore PET, in all likelihood. It was a little rabbit hutch-looking thing, yeah, the big white thing with the square monitor on top of it. All the schools in England used basically something along those lines. And, yeah, as you said, we saw it from a distance. It was usually in a locked room. We might get to go ooh and ah over it, but the school had one, and it was probably a Commodore PET. And it was a big deal because it was one of the first sub-$1,000 computers that ever came out.
Did it also become one of the big, therefore, personal the early PCs that were widely purchased?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was one of those ones that really sort of brought the PC to public attention, and people started realising that the P of PC was relevant. The personal aspect of it could make sense. You could actually have a computer on your desktop. What he did next in 1980 was the VIC-20, which really was a personal computer. It was one of the very first ones that people could buy, bring home, plug into your telly instead of using an actual computer monitor. So it suddenly brought down the price of entry. I think it was about $300 in the US to buy these things. They were quite affordable. And it got a lot of people into programming, and it got them into learning about computers. So he was really powerful in that. The other thing that's worth mentioning about him was back in the early 80s, if you remember the Atari video game system, they were wonderful.
Yeah, I remember them. Were they the ones with, what was the name of that famous tennis game where literally it's a little square?
Oh, you were talking about Pong.
Yeah, well, that was on Atari, wasn't it?
No, Atari were way better than that. Atari was in colour.
What do you mean it was better? That was the best video game ever.
I know, it's hard to imagine anything could ever be
Pong. A couple of bricks and a little square thing.
I know, I mean, life
hours of fun.
Life didn't get any better than that, did it? But then out came the Atari, and they had the joysticks, and they had Space Invaders and all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
I mean, this is nostalgia overload here. But Jack Tramiel railed against this, and he kept pointing out, you know, these are a pile of rubbish. They're games, they're passive. They're not cerebral or possibly cerebral enough.
I could never work that one out. More on that later in the hour. Gavin Ellis will tell us which it is.
I shall wait with bated breath. But the smart bloke, he said, you know, don't buy the games because, you know, they're just games. Learn to program. But then he was smart enough to realise 4 years later that he actually bought the Atari company because he realised that's the way things were going.
He's not the guy who famously said, "I bought the company," is he?
No, that was Victor Kiam.
That was the razor man.
Yeah, it was Victor Kiam bought Remington.
The shaver man.
Yes.
The Commodore 64 was the one we perhaps best knew.
Yes. That was his really big thing. That was the one that really brought the idea of home computers to the forefront within him. I mean, back in Britain, we had the Sinclair range, the ZX Spectrum, and those that were also of the same era and of the same kind of end of the market, and it says Spectrum then, but there would be no Pauling. They were the same kind of thing. These were small, low-powered, but very, very accessible computers that got an awful lot of people started realising, hang on a second, I can actually use this thing. And not just that, I could make money programming this thing as well. And it was people like Jack Tramiel in the US and Clive Sinclair back in the UK who really kick-started the idea of computers as something for individuals. And then a few years down the line, then you're going to start to see people like Steve Jobs coming in with the Apple range, and the rest really is just history.
Yeah, it is indeed. And so that is Jack Tramiel. Thank you, Steve McCabe, our technology commentator today.